When I started studying for my biblical studies degree, 13 years ago now, time flies, one of our tutor's leitmotifs was, it is essential that you wrestle with the biblical text. You have to discern when to read with the text or against the text. To be honest, it took me some time to understand what they meant. I had never heard that before, so I was quite baffled. How do you fight with a text? And what does read against the text means? But soon I came to realize that the meaning of the biblical text is not fixed once and for all, but always ongoing and evolving as new questions emerge, new insights appear. So we must be ready to revise the so-called traditional interpretations, which might not be adapted to our 21st century worldview. And this is what the great Jewish New Testament scholar, Amy Jill Levine, calls welcoming new voices to the interpretive table. I like that expression, interpretive table, as it suggests the idea of partaking in what the Bible text offers. Like a meal you share with people around you. But beware, when you start, it can be quite a full meal to digest with unexpected flavors. And Amy Jill adds, the Bible is not just a form of ancient literature like Homer, Plato, or Virgil, but it still speaks from the past to our present. So we need to engage with this text to find the reading that provides us with the good news we need in our present context. And she uses a simple metaphor about wrestling with the biblical text. She says, it's like the relationship you have with a best friend, a spouse, or a partner. When the love is strong enough, then honesty is not a threat. You may argue forcefully, strongly disagree, but the love continues. And she concludes, it is the same with the biblical text. We argue and wrestle with it, but because we love it, honesty is not a threat. And boy, did I wrestle for a long time with the story of Martha and Mary. Not openly, of course, as it was certainly not something I had been encouraged to do when I was growing up. And maybe quite a few of you have had the same experience privately. This is an important story, as all the four evangelists recount it, and it's very familiar indeed. How many times have all of us women been asked, are you a Martha or Mary? Being a Martha is not very desirable, as she's seemingly depicted as a harried housewife, clattering in the kitchen, preoccupied with her pots and pans, who ask her illustrious guest, a man, to get involved in a domestic quarrel, and whining to him that Mary was not pulling her weight in doing the house chores. Instead, it's much better to be a Mary, silent, lovingly and serenely listening at the feet of Jesus. By the way, it's worth noting that this text has been used in the past to justify the silencing of women voices in many churches. But the main consequence of such a reading is a dichotomy between the two sisters. Active Martha being chastised for caring too much about the dinner, and contemplative Mary, silent and retiring, being affirmed as having the better part. Does that help women, or anybody for that matter? No, it does not, as it creates a very false division between being and doing, between activity and contemplation in the spiritual life when we are supposed to do both. The thing is, I don't think this story is really about that. So, with the help of several modern scholars, whose name I won't burden you with, but that I would be happy to provide if you're interested, let's try to find out what is really going on in that story, as there are important elements that have been either passed over or misinterpreted. The first thing we are told about Mary is that she also sat at the Lord's feet. Also, that little word Kai in the Greek text is present in the King James Version, but is omitted in most modern translations, which is a shame because it means obviously that there was someone else at the feet of the Lord. And it's very important because we tend to read sat at the feet of Jesus literally. What it simply meant, following Jesus and being a disciple. For example, in Acts 22, verse 3, Paul writes of having been brought up at the feet of Gamaliel. And the Gerasene demoniac, once healed, was sitting at the feet of Jesus, says Luke in chapter 8. This is a figurative expression, which means learn from a teacher and follow him as a disciple. So, logically, it means that Mary and also Martha both were sitting at the feet of the Lord. In other words, both were disciples. Okay, so far so good, yes? Now, hold on to your hats, as an interesting possibility suggested by several scholars might shock you. And it is that Mary might not even have been there physically with Jesus in the house of a sister. What? I can hear you, some of you, say. I know, this is a jarring idea, given the way we have been imagining the scene for centuries, reinforced by so many paintings, like the one by Vermeer that you have on your order of service. But stay with the idea for a moment. It is Martha who is described as welcoming Jesus into her own home, not Martha and Mary. And there is no mention of their brother Lazarus, or, for that matter, of Jesus' disciples either. He came to a village, we read in verse 38, not they came to a village. So, the possibility of Jesus being alone in the house with Martha is quite strong. But then, where is Mary? Martha's question to Jesus is interesting in this regard. She says, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself?" So, excuse me. An interesting possibility offered by several scholars is that Mary has been sent out to do missionary work, being part, maybe, of the 72 disciples sent out in the passage in Luke that we heard very recently. It is well documented that many women were following and helping Jesus and the 12 in their itinerant ministry. We know of Mary of Magdala, Joanna, Susanna, Lydia, and many others, not named. Paul also mentions several women disciples who were helping him, either by opening their home or proselytizing with him. Priscilla, Phoebe, Prisca, among others, who were engaged in patronage and missionary work. It also seems that many of these female followers of Jesus were not married or were widows. So in the society of the time, it was that freedom from patriarchal expectations that freed these women to fulfill their potential as disciples. Now, what about Martha? The text says she was troubled as she was greatly distracted about much service. Two important things here. First, the word usually translated service, diakonia in Greek, does not mean table service, but ministry. In the 8 times that word is used in Luke's Gospel and in Acts, it does not describe kitchen activity, but task of leadership and ministry. Secondly, Luke uses 2 very strong Greek words to describe Martha's frame of mind. He writes, she was merinas, which means greatly distracted, but in the sense of pulled in too many directions about everything she had to do. So she was thoribase, troubled, literally in a state of clamor. Was having to cook a meal, probably for only one guest, cause her to be in a state of clamor? Don't think so. This is not mere domestic drama, and it's not about Martha having to do the washing up on her own. Rather, nowadays, we would say she was overworked and was consequently highly stressed. Basically, she was experiencing a burnout. So, where does all that leave us? Well, the two sisters are both faithful disciples of Jesus. But Martha is overwhelmed by the demands of the local community, and she does too much. And yes, she does resent her sister Mary, who is probably not at home, to pull her weight and help her in all this task of local ministry. But Mary has responded to a different calling, and she has chosen a different path, maybe to follow Jesus and the 12 in their itinerant ministry. So Jesus doesn't expect these two women, or all women for that matter, to behave all the same way in their discipleship. He simply says that Mary's choice is good, as the Greek expression agathon merida can be read as good choice rather than the comparative better. A choice that she should continue, as it will not be taken from her. But Martha's choice of local ministry is also good, but as she has been spreading herself too thinly, she's exhausted, worried, stressed out, and therefore distracted from the real purpose of her life. And because she's trying too hard, she has lost her focus. And that's why she's doing all she does. Jesus, with the great understanding of human emotions that he had, can see that Martha is highly distraught, and he shows compassion and understanding to her. With the usual economy of words that characterizes all the gospel writers, Luke reports that Jesus says only one sentence to Martha. But you can't really think that Jesus says only one sentence to her and goes on his way. A real and probably long conversation took place between the two, a sort of counseling session in a way. What we have in the text is just the gist of that conversation. He says to her, and of course to all of us, "Don't worry, Martha. Few things are needed, or indeed only one." But what is that one thing? Jesus doesn't elaborate, but this is the real lesson of that story. So we must hazard a guess. And you might come up with a different answer from me, which is fine. My own guess is that the only and most important thing that Jesus is alluding to is responding to God's calling to the kind of ministry that is suited to our different gifts, strength, and capacity. Not with anxiety, but with deep joy. There is no value judgment here, and one is not better than the other. It is only with that kind of deep, joyful response that we will feel fulfilled, free, and efficient in our discipleship. Amen.